other night was actually the first time that I was here at your church. I've heard a lot about it. We've been thinking of you, praying for you over the years. When I came into the church, that was way back in 1993. So I suppose there's no excuse, really, for never getting up here, except they say in Ulster, it's manners to be asked. But I really thank the Lord for the opportunity to be here and meet you folks. And I don't know whether some of you have been here for many, many years or you're just new, because I don't think I really know any of the folks here. But it's really great, as I say, to have the opportunity. I don't want to forget at the outset to say a word of thanks to you as a church for praying for us as we've labored in Liberia, myself and my colleague Joanne Greer. And she asked me also, wherever I go, to convey thanks to you for your prayer and for your support for the work there. You have a work here. It's very similar to our work. Sometimes I think we get this, pardon me if I sound, it's not a criticism, but I'll say it's my thinking. We have a romanticism about working in a foreign country. And what we're doing out there is exactly what you're doing here. We're seeking to establish a church. And so we preach the gospel, and then we seek to help believers go on for God when they come to know Christ. We may have different challenges that you have because perhaps the cultural background, or particularly when you deal with many sub-Saharan African countries, you're dealing with a lot of corruption. Maybe that comes into government or in the society or in the courts. Those benefits that may be in our countries here, because we've had the effects of the Protestant Reformation that has shaken our countries to the very core. When I say our countries, I'm an American, but I think we could speak broadly of North America. So it is a little different in that sense, and you face a lot of challenges when you seek to bring righteousness, even in your own conduct and how you live, and even when you preach how righteousness is worked out in a believer's life. But we are really doing the same thing that you are doing, and we do appreciate your prayers for us as we work and labor. I do want to give you something of a report about the work in Liberia, because maybe you don't know a lot about it. The work in Liberia really started back in 2007 on March 12. That's when our denomination here in North America actually incorporated a non-governmental organization. It's not actually a church. It's an NGO called the Free Presbyterian Mission Church of Liberia. And that came about because there was a man in the Malvern Free Presbyterian Church outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, that is a mentally challenged man. Some would think, well, what could he do for God? But he took gospel tracts. He went down to the train station in Philadelphia, and he handed them out to people that got off the train. And there was a man that got off the train from Liberia, West Africa, that had been given asylum by the U.S. government because his life was under threat during the 14-year Civil War. The reason it was under threat was he was a preacher, and he had several congregations that he had started, and he preached a sermon, and I don't know whether he wrote the sermon out or someone took notes on his sermon, but someone thought it was so good that they published it in the newspaper, and they misquoted him, and it got interpreted as if he was speaking against the government. And this was a time when Charles Taylor, if you've heard that name, he's actually in prison right now in the United Kingdom. He was brought to the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague, and he was charged and convicted and serving a prison sentence. He won the election in Liberia on the campaign slogan, "I killed your ma, I killed your pa, now vote for me." And he was involved. He wasn't convicted for his crimes in Liberia, but for what happened in Sierra Leone. If you understand anything about blood diamonds, you can Google that and read a little bit about that. But that's where he got himself into trouble. It's funny because a lot of people today say even in Liberia it was a good day because the prices were more easy to afford. Yet, but that was not really freedom and free market economics where you had fair competition. It was Charles Taylor actually through blood diamonds keeping the prices down where people could afford them. But that's really not the way to do it. You don't do that by crime and by sin. But at the end of the day, this preacher, Chester Matadi, that got off the train in Philadelphia, he ended up becoming a target, and he came to our church after he got that tract. And he sat under the preaching for a couple years. and never really said anything about his people back in Liberia. And then after he heard the doctrine in our church, he said to Dr. Mark Allison, I have a people that I've left when I fled the country back in Liberia that they need help. They need spiritual guidance and direction. Would you come? And so Dr. Allison, one of the elders in the church there in Malvern, who is originally from Haiti, he came, Paul C. Kanji, and then also a gentleman from Northern Ireland, George McConnell. Some might know that name. George is very well known in our churches around the world for having a burden to get books into the hands of God's people and even good Christian literature. His motto is sort of the same idea, he says, as Martin Luther in the 16th century, that really believed in the importance of literature and good materials. And so those three men went out in 2006, 2007. Some of you, if Joanne was actually here, I believe she was, so she might have showed you the video. They shot a lot of video back then when they first arrived and what it was like. The war ended in 2003, so they were coming just after elections, 2006, 2007, so the country was still in very, very bad shape, and it was quite an eye-opener to them. And when they went, they started a bookstore, and they had men that wanted to become a part of this work of the Free Presbyterian Church. Now, some of those that were there in the very beginning, as always happens, they went away. They had other ideas of what it would mean to get involved in a Western church. Even our people that are with us today will tell us that they think they were more interested in money. And you can sort of understand that when you've been through a number of years of civil war. But though we do help the poor, those who fit that description of poverty, our main goal, in even though we help the poor, is to preach the gospel. So we had four men that wanted to sign up to become a part of our work and our witness. And so today we actually have three men left that are pastoring churches. One of the churches has decided to leave us, but the one main church is in a place called Painesville, and that's about 7 miles outside of the capital city of Liberia. The capital city is Monrovia, and that pastor's name is Moses Don. We have in that church about 40 people, and that's actually the church where Joanne and myself have sort of parked ourselves. When I first got there, I was trying to visit around to the churches, and I found that that actually wasn't working. The people and these men come from somewhat of a Pentecostal background, and they really maybe don't understand all the things that we would understand. I mean, they certainly have been through a number of workshops by the time I got there. Dr. Allison had traveled to the field twice a year for probably, 4 years, training the men before I actually got there. And so now that I'm here, that's my work to train them and teach them. And so I was trying to go around to the different churches, but we found that that wasn't really effective. Some of it was even the hymns, trying to learn some of the hymns. Before the war, they had hymn books, but all of that got destroyed during the war. So they would know some of the hymns, and they want to sing the hymns, but they need someone to lead. And it's great because Joanne plays the piano. And so that it helps them, and then I can lead. And our church then in Painesville has done very, very well. Then we also have another church, which is technically in Painesville, but it's in a place called Bala Creek, about 2 miles away from the Painesville church. And that is Pastor Saki Moba. And he has about 50 people in his church. He also runs a Christian school. We don't technically call it a Christian school, because it's not yet certified by the government. One of the challenges, again, is that when you're coming out of the Civil War, the government is trying to sort things and get things in order, and so it's hard to get things certified sometimes unless you give money under the table. We don't, of course, do that, partially because, I mean, the U.S. law as a U.S. citizen is a little different than the British law, where my colleague Joanne is. The British law is very, very strict. It's called the Bribery Act. You cannot even give a tip to a government official. That's classified as a bribe automatically, anybody that's in the position of authority. And, of course, America, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, is a little bit more lenient. They said you can sort of tip to get your driver's license or your visa, but we don't do it. We follow, at least while I'm there, we follow the British law. I think it's safer. It keeps you above board. But in having a Christian school, you face those types of challenges, and you have to work a lot harder. to get those things done that you need. And, of course, we teach our people to render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. We believe that you abide by the laws of the land. And that's not easy in a society that tends to have a lawless mindset because they have not had the same benefits of the gospel. So that's our second church that has a Christian school. And then we have a third church. Now, this third church is about 4 to 6 hours away, depending on the weather. It's really quite good because the Chinese are in the country at the moment paving a lot of the roads in exchange for iron ore. And therefore, we can get to this church a whole lot quicker than we used to be able to. It's a place called Riverses. The pastor there is named Andrew Joe. Some of you might know that name and because his wife just recently died. And so he is left with three children, and I know he would appreciate your prayers. A lot of our people have been praying for him. We, of course, are. You can get regular updates. You have in each of our churches, and I assume it's here too, the missionary prayer bulletin. We're actually starting, through the publications committee of our denomination, a website that we are really trying to get the missionaries to write updates for, and that's at fpcnamissions.org. That's actually not been officially approved yet, but it's pretty much in the works, and so you can check that. You'll get little cards in your church, and it'll allow you to go on the web anytime if you want to sign up for Twitter, and then maybe some of you don't know what that is, but then you can get updates for the work there in all of our mission fields, including Liberia. So those are our three main churches. And then we also have in our church work, I should tell you about Joanne's work. Normally what we've been doing in our churches is we're showing a 15-minute video that kind of tells you a lot, so I don't say those things. And so I have to remember now that we're not actually showing the video because we're not really on a Wednesday night here. We're in a main service. But Joanne does a lot of work with Bible clubs, with a Sunday school. There's a couple fellows, one in our Painesville church, also one in our Bala Creek church, that she's helping, and they're really coming along very well and teaching the children and organizing a Sunday school program for both of those churches. We've tried before to start Sunday school programs, and you have the challenge where the kids will come, but then to get the teachers to consistently come. And that's what you're dealing with in societies that for years have not had the benefits of the gospel. You know, the scripture even says when Paul preached to Corinth, he had to say to them, do all things decently and in order, because there was that tendency, perhaps because of the pagan background, where things were not done orderly. And that was really something that we found very difficult. So when Joanne came, she was able to really set up the Sunday schools, and the men that are in charge of that are really doing a tremendous job as they're going forward, and we're thankful to the Lord for that. She also does a reading club, and of course the idea there is to teach children to read the Word of God. I can speak for my own country in America that in the late 1600s there was a great concern because parents were not actually starting grammar schools and teaching their children how to read. And so America made up the Education Act, at least it was in the state of Massachusetts, I think it was the 1680s, where they said whenever a community got 100 families, they were required by law to start a grammar school so that the children could learn to read and so that they could, number one, read the Bible, and number two, read the laws of the land, because there was a great concern in the early parts of America that children would grow up and not elect people, put people into office that were actually Christians. That sounds very strange to say today, but the reality is that was very important back then in the early history of America. And so she teaches the children to read, and that is a challenge. Now, Liberia, the national language is English, but it's really the second language for everybody there because they have their own native tribal language. If you go to somewhere like Kenya, you have two national languages. You have Swahili, but you also have English. When you come in, and then everybody has the tribal languages well. So normally, a lot of people actually know three languages in Kenya. But in Liberia, the national language is English. Although if I would show you the video tonight, you can hear one of the boys, the children speak Liberian English. It's a little bit different than our English, but it is actually English. It's not pidgin English. It's just mostly the accent. because depending on what tribe they're from, so it's hard then to understand them. But one of the challenges she faces is when you start to deal with phonics, maybe they haven't learned all the pronunciation, and you have to then teach them that. And that's a challenge because you think to yourself, here, you're a foreigner. You're always wrestling when you come into a foreign country. Are the things I'm trying to change, is that my cultural mindset as a Westerner, or is this a biblical thing? And of course, we believe the Lord ordained language. The only language in the world is not English, of course, but if they're speaking English, we would say they have to speak standard English. And most people in Liberia feel that way because now we're in an international community, really, where a lot of jobs are connected with other countries, and English seems to be the standard language. So that's very helpful because, quite frankly, when you're learning to study the Bible, oftentimes you find a lot of helps that are actually written in English, and that opens up a whole door. But that is their language, and she teaches reading club, and she also does piano lessons because it's our prayer that many of these children would grow up and learn how to play the piano so that they can, in the church, have that. Now, that's what they do play in churches. In Liberia. Liberia is very much an American culture because it was a country that was founded by freed American slaves that left America in 1822, and then they became an independent country in 1847, and were really a model for all of sub-Saharan Africa because of that being an independent African country that was actually run by Africans. And although then eventually they got into trouble with civil war and so forth. But many of the things that we would come in and see, it's very Americanized, if I could put it that way, in the culture. One of the challenges, though, we have to deal with is that many people understand America or the West in their perhaps romanticized mindset. So they would love to come to America. We try to tell them that there are benefits to America, but you still have sin and you still have problems and you still have challenges. And the best thing to do, perhaps, is to learn in your own country. Although if you're going to get education right now, it's a challenge in Liberia because of the corruption in the local university of Liberia. It would be my prayer that we could start a Christian school and also start even like a university. When I say university, I don't just mean a Bible college. I mean a liberal arts college where you're learning all subjects in the context of the Bible. You're going to deal with law. You're going to have to address the issue of the Bible, what the Scripture says about that. And, of course, if you're going to address economics, there's plenty to say, which is actually the subject and the will of the Lord that I was going to talk about tonight because I don't normally get a report at the same time as the message. I'm sort of combining the two together. And I am conscious of the time. I'm looking at the clock, so don't panic. I said to some people I hadn't been back to the States really or to our churches in 7 years, and they got a little nervous thinking I was actually going to give 7 years of everything that's in my head in one message. But just as the Lord leads. But I did want to give you a little bit of a sense of what Joanne is doing out there. My work has been, as I said a minute ago, training the pastors. And I did that for a year and a half. I've been there for 3.5 years. And then two trips I took before that twice, which were about 3 months each time. Joanne has been there for 2.5 years. Joanne is actually the official full-time missionary. I'm actually a missionary at large. So I'm sort of laboring to help all the works in some sense. But I'm parked right now in Liberia. And what they asked me to do was to train the ministers, but also set up a missionary housing, you know, property there so that in the future, as God calls missionaries, then we can have a place for them. One of the challenges that we faced right away when we went to Liberia was that we were in a post-war country. So if you're a Westerner and you want security in a house or an apartment to rent, you're going to pay a tremendous amount of money. The average Liberian can live in an apartment for $25 a month or $75. They can get some for $120, which are actually quite nice. You think $120. So the cost of living is very much different there. Sometimes, by the way, when they say people only make $2 a day or $1 a day, that can be a little bit confusing to our mindset because they're not paying $800, $1,200 a month for rent. So it's a little different. They have, you know, those facilities, they have a toilet just like we would have in like $75 a month place. All of that is available there to them. So at the end of the day, though, for us, because partly security, and there's 15,000 UN troops there, there's a section of town really for foreigners. And it's not actually only foreigners, but it is an area that's been declared by the UN to be safe. But it's expensive to live there. So we were paying about $3,200 a month. My apartment was basically a glorified closet. I didn't mind it. That was the term of one of our elders. I actually like a small place. It's easier to clean and all of that. And that was $1,000 a month. It was one bedroom, little kitchen, living room. It was actually very nice. Joanne's was $2,200. And the idea was if visitors came, she had a couple bedrooms in the place. And so we were paying about $3,200 a month. That's U.S. dollars. And so the question was, could we get our own property and possibly match that cost monthly with running cost on a property? And that's exactly, amazingly, about what it's costing us now that we have a property to run it per month. And by the way, to put missionaries on the field, remember when I was in Kenya, I spent 3 years in Kenya, and I said to one of our men out there, does North America realize, and I wouldn't have realized, how much it really does cost to put missionaries on the field? And I look at missions like we are there to work ourselves out of a job. We are foreigners in their country, and we want to help them to go forward. And our prayer is, as we are now the Free Presbyterian Mission Church of Liberia, that eventually will be the Free Presbyterian Church of Liberia, where they are running their work completely. And so my time has been taken up really with the building project. And then some of you may know that back in July, that was of 2013, when I was in bed at night at 3:15 or 3:20 in the morning, I heard what I thought was a mouse in my kitchen. Not that I'm expecting mice in my kitchen, although Joanne might say that I don't clean up as much as I should. But I went out to check what it was, only because I thought it could be some thieves, but I never dreamed it was, and I knew I wouldn't be able to get back to sleep if I didn't check this. Well, I did check it, and sure enough, as I came out into the kitchen, there were two men. It was pitch dark, but I saw flashlights. There were two men standing in the kitchen, and there were two men coming through the window. And, of course, we have window bars up, and I couldn't figure out how the window bars, how is it they're not there. I could sort of see that they were gone. And these men then, as they saw me, attacked me. And I have to say, I thought for sure at that time I was going to die, because one of the things, and I found this out after, was robbery is a huge problem in Liberia. And the police really don't have guns, so you can't really make a phone call to get help. There are some UN police, but they're really there for support. They're starting to train some special forces, the Emergency Response Unit in Liberia. But again, because they've had war, you got to be careful putting guns into people's hands. I'm an American. You might understand something about our Constitution, Second Amendment rights, the right to bear arms. And I always say, I said this to our churches, I'm going to keep preaching it. You know, we get this idea that the right to bear arms, we must have them. And I believe in that. I believe in defending yourself. But we have that in the context of a nation that had the gospel. So if you want to take that idea of the Second Amendment and put it into Liberia, where they have not had the same benefits of the gospel, you will have civil war. So they're being very cautious in how they deal with issues like that. But then that makes it very difficult if you're trying to defend yourself or even to put arms into the hands of police officers who are oftentimes very corrupt and are part of the theft ring. And I say that because that's what the Liberians themselves will tell us. And so that caused us, that robbery. Thankfully, the men didn't take my life. They had machetes. They asked where the money was. And it was amazing. Just the value of money just went right down in my mind. Your life is really everything at that point. And I think certainly that's a promotion of the sixth commandment, although I know they were coming to violate the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal. But I was thinking, thou shalt not kill. And I cooperated with them and actually preached to them. I actually said to them, I was under a great deal of fear. You can imagine waking up at night, but I just shouted out the words that came into my mind. I said, "Do you men not fear God?" And later someone said I heard a preacher explaining my testimony, and he said that was the very word that the repentant thief on the cross quoted to the unrepentant thief. And I thought, well, there the Lord gave me that word. And there was a UN soldier that the same thing happened to him shortly before that, and he was murdered. And people are murdered all the time, thieves coming into the house. And I thought I would die that night. But it caused us to look a lot at security. And so we had to raise the wall on our security property. And by the way, if you come to Liberia, you will see that mostly everybody lives that way, including the Liberians, because there is so much theft. Someone saw some photographs of our property, and it looks almost like a prison. We have a guard tower. We now have the same guard company that guards the British embassy. And just a few months back, we saw there were 15 men, or between 8 to 15 men, with machetes hiding in the field just outside of our gate. So I don't want to make you think we're living in a war zone. We're really not. And you'll find that Liberians are very, very friendly people, even to foreigners. But some of that is starting to change. And I think part of that is because they are looking to their government to do that which they should be doing for themselves. And so they get irritated because they're not being provided with the things they, like government's supposed to create jobs. I never believed that. The government is supposed to facilitate the creation of jobs by addressing the courts and law, you know, honesty and judges that aren't corrupt, so that a foreign investor can come in and feel comfortable signing a contract that the money he invests is actually going to go to the right thing. That then creates jobs, and so Liberians are then hired, and they should be given a fair wage, and then they can build the infrastructure of their country. They pay taxes to the government, who also builds roads and electrical grids and all of that, but they are the ones that invest in their own communities, and that's the type of thing you want to see. But the bottom line is some of that is indeed not happening. So bottom line is, with our property, we had to build that up and be a lot more secure. And even the Liberians, after the robbery, we learned a lot of things we didn't know before. This has happened to them as well, and it's a huge problem. We have some friends that are missionaries from America, Bob Jones University graduates, which is a fundamental Bible-believing school. They said when they first came to Liberia 35 years ago, they didn't have any security. And the Liberian said to them, "You need to get security. You need to put walls up." So that's what they tell us. Some people will say, "Oh, as missionaries, isn't it like you're closing yourself in and you've got like your little America?" No, no, no. It's not like that at all. It is there for the purposes of security. And at the end of the day, that has taken up a lot of my time. The construction project has been very, very difficult. Some of that is also the work ethic, workers coming on time, giving money to someone to do a job, and then they don't do what they say they're going to do. They don't bring the equipment. You're dealing and addressing with all those things. So I had to stop teaching. I had to stop teaching and come and become a contractor. I said to some of our men, I don't remember ever learning that in seminary, but it's necessary. And it also is good because, you know, a lot of times workers that come to do a job, the contractor above them does not pay them. One of the things they know about us is we pay them. And we pay them well. We have a cement man that does a very good job. He's not great with business and money, but he's really good at what he does. And so I've tried to help him. I may get in trouble for this, but I said to him one time, "You're not charging enough for this job." He wasn't. It was not even a fair. How do you know a fair wage? Well, you know by the cost of living and staple foods. And if he's got a wife and he's got a child, you can look at it that way. So that's been a lot of my job. Let me say one other thing by way of report. And again, I'm conscious of the time. I have just a word to just bring to you today, just a thought, actually, from a verse in Proverbs. But when I mentioned to you in the very beginning that George McConnell from our church in Northern Ireland came out with the team that originally went there, he very much is burdened for the getting books into the hands of people. And so he started a bookstore, a Christian bookstore. Liberia, before the war, used to have a Christian bookstore. And when I came out, one of the challenges was, again, the person that was left to run it, it wasn't run very well. lot of the money, really, as the Liberian will say, got eaten. And what I wanted to do was run the bookstore without any foreign money. One of the things that I've been challenged about in going to Liberia was, if you look at our countries here, Canada and America, North America, people in Liberia will often say, we need money from you folks because you're very wealthy. And I've said to them, actually, you folks are far wealthier than we are, because if you look at our countries here, Canada and America, you think of our growing season, how short the growing season is. When you look at the homesteaders in America, it's the same in your country. When they were planting crops, they had a very short time before the frost and the snow came. And yet what is strange is we are the breadbasket for really the world when you think about North America. But if you come into countries like Liberia, and even the president, Ellen Johnson, you will hear her right now because of the Ebola virus saying, now, is this the thing that will help you to start putting crops in the ground and stop slash and burn farming? Real farming that will enable us not only to feed our own people, to export. Liberia is now importing a lot of their rice and their staple foods, and that's not because of the war. It's just the mindset that is in the people, and President Johnson has really been challenging that, especially during the Ebola virus when the borders are closed. So my prayer was, with a bookstore, let's use that not only to provide literature, but to teach the people about business, because the Bible does say a lot about business, right? What happened was, and I believe because we're in the capital city, this does help, but it's not just UN soldiers that buy from our bookstore, it is Liberians as well. We have 400 US dollar calfskin leather Bibles for pulpit Bibles, and we also have $1 paperback Bibles, and all the Bibles in between. And so what we've been able to do is actually have a bookstore now that is making its own profit, and to where we're able to cut money off from overseas, and we're able to pay our own salaries, our own electricity. We're able to put an air conditioner in. We're able to buy our own books now and order exactly what we want, one title of different books instead of what we were doing before. We had like 20 titles of the same book, it's 20 copies of the same title, and able to just have one copy. That was like a business idea that I thought would be a lot better, because now you can, before we maybe only had 50 books in the store, now we have 1,100 different titles. And that helps a lot. We also print in gold foil someone's name on the front of the Bible, leather Bible, for free, if they buy a Bible from us. And at the end of the day, the bookstore is done very, very well. And one thing we did was we tripled our salaries of our workers to give them a good wage. Now, that whenever you're dealing with a nonprofit corporation, you can't give extreme salaries, and you do have to look at the cost of living. But we wanted to teach very much that if a man works hard, you know, the Bible says a lot about work. I'm going to talk a little bit about that today, tonight. But you've got to give a fair wage. The Westminster Confession or the Larger Catechism actually addresses those issues under the Eighth Commandment. And so, of course, they were very happy, but we're happy too, because if they show up on time for work and they do a good job and they're familiar with the inventory, and then we pay them a fair wage. And that the Lord has provided now for us for 2.5 years, even during the Ebola virus. We're getting a little bit worried. And the Lord sent in some people from the Salvation Army from Guinea, and they spent $2,300 on books in one day. And the books they bought, actually, there was a ton of them. A ton of the people, they weren't our one-book items. They were like our staple stock that sort of sits and is always there, books that you really have to have, like Strong's Concordance and other books. So we didn't have to restock. So we were able to hold that cash in case we get in problems with Ebola, because we don't want to leave our workers high and dry. So we have that as a reserve. So the Lord is taking care of the bookstore. It is a ministry. It's a nonprofit. Just means all your money has to come back into the store. Anything goes out through payroll. We pay taxes to the government on their payroll. But it's a great ministry because people come in from all different backgrounds. They're looking for different books and different titles, often from Pentecostal preachers. And I've trained our workers to don't say, no, we don't have that. Say, we don't have that, but let me show you something on the same subject that we do have. Because it's a teaching opportunity. People have not grown up with our background, so you have to teach them. And the store's been a tremendous opportunity in that way. But one of the things we did in the store that was different was we sought advertising. How do we advertise our store? Internet is not common there because it for the average Liberian to get on the Internet, it would be 1 month's salary under the government minimum wage. So that was out. But what everybody does is listen to radio. And they have a phone, and all their cell phones have an FM tuner. Friends of mine in America said, we don't have that here. Maybe you have it in Canada. I don't know. But they have it. So everybody listens to the radio. And so I suggested we get onto the government station, which has a 10,000-watt FM station in Monrovia, but they have 5 transponders that go throughout the whole country. And so I started doing radio commercials. At first, it was a Liberian fellow that we hired from some studio that did the commercial, but the station rejected it, and we didn't know what to do, and the man at the station says, why don't you do it as an American voice, and maybe that would intrigue people. And so I did. I remember an ad campaign. I did some radio television in America. I remember learning about one of the most successful radio ads in America. It was actually a motel called Motel 6, and the guy that did the read for the commercial, he just added something at the very end that wasn't in the script. He just said his name. He said, I'm Tom Beaudet for Motel 6, and we'll leave the light on for you. And it was really personable, and it was successful. So I did something like that at the end of the commercial. I'm Dave DiCanio, and we'll look forward to seeing you. Wherever I go in Monrovia or even 4 hours in the interior, if I say my name to people, they say, you're that guy on the radio, or you guys have that bookstore. And it's been amazing to me. And it was just after that, we had 5 people a week coming in the store, but then when we did the ads, it was 10 people a day. And that was the big difference. And it made me think, why not do the Let the Bible Speak program? Our denomination has Let the Bible Speak as its radio ministry. And so that's what we started to do. And just a few months ago, I went over to Northern Ireland. We were doing a once-a-week program on the government station across the country. So there's 4.4 million people in Liberia and then 1.4 in Monrovia. And again, everybody listens to radio. Everybody listens to the main government station. And they also listen to this large Christian station. And we're also on their station. And we were doing once-a-week programs, and then Let the Bible Speak in Northern Ireland sponsored a daily program on both those stations. Actually, the government station's 4 days a week, and the Christian is 7 days a week for a 15-minute program. And so that started when we were evacuated because of Ebola. So I'm working on that now, putting it up on the Internet, the Dropbox, and they're airing those while I'm here. And so that's been a great door, and I would appreciate your prayers for the work, your continued prayers. I want to just speak on a very quickly in the next few minutes, just some thoughts on Proverbs 14, verse 34. It's a very familiar verse to you. It's just a verse, you can turn there if you want, but it's just a verse as I was flying over on the plane that came to my mind when I thought about what I wanted to speak to you about. And it's the verse that says, righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. One of the challenges that you find, at least that I found, in going into a developing country, I wanted to know when I first went to Kenya, and I also wanted to know when I first went to Liberia, you know, what is it that makes nations struggle? Why is it that people find it so difficult, even as Christians, to go forward in regard to their life and how a nation operates? And let me say at the outset here that I don't believe in the social gospel. You know what the social gospel is, right? Churches that don't hold to the Bible anymore, don't have the gospel, well, you know, they're churches, so they have to do something charitable. So what do? Well, they give money. They give help to people that are in need. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's a good thing. The reason, though, it has a bad name is because it's usually churches that don't preach the Bible anymore or the gospel that do that. But charity is a good thing. The Bible does actually say in 1 John 3, whoever has this world's goods, and we do in this part of the world, you see your brother have need, you shut up your bowels of compassion from him. Well, does the love of God really dwell in you? No, it doesn't. And, of course, in the early church, they did take collections. They did take offerings for those that had need. Every man according to his ability determined to send relief, as you remember, to the brethren at Jerusalem. When you look at different countries and you look at, when I look at the countries that I came to labor in, I had a great question even about those nations and the difficulties they were facing and how it is that they could be helped. And I wrestled with that issue of the social gospel. Well, I don't believe in the social gospel, but I do believe in the gospel. And if it's the gospel and you preach it, it will absolutely affect that society. Now, if it's a revival like the Protestant Reformation, which was a massive move of God that converted so many thousands of people that it completely shaped entire nations and cultures. You're dealing with Germany, with Martin Luther. You're dealing with France, with John Calvin. You're dealing with John Knox in Scotland. And, of course, the influences of Scotland upon Northern Ireland. And if you look at the founders of, I could just say, my country in America, you certainly do have the Scots-Irish that came to America, the first ones that came and founded America. And, of course, in your country here, you had some of those Scots-Irish migrate up here. You had others that came directly from England. And, of course, that was the Puritans who were seeking to purify the church from within. You also, in our country, have the Separatists that left the Church of England, and it came and established colonies in America. And really, when you look at nations and the why they are the way they are today, it is directly connected and related to the gospel. There's many things you could address. If you, there's no time tonight to really address everything, but if I want to address the effects that the gospel has upon a nation, I'm addressing righteousness, because righteousness that exalts or raises up a nation, it first deals with the doctrine of justification, doesn't it? You are dealing with men being justified. But once a man is justified by free grace and rests in Christ without any works of his own, he's recognizing that Christ's righteousness is the ground of his standing, that man is very liberated. That man has a joy of the Lord. Now he wants to honor the Lord. He loves the Lord. If you love me, keep my commandments, Christ said. And of course, we know theologically from Paul's epistles that once a man is justified, that man then is sanctified. The work of sanctification begins in his life. And that's also righteousness. That's not an imputed righteousness, but it is an infused righteousness. And now that man, as he's regenerated by the grace of God, the seed remains in him, and his life changes. And that affects his society, especially when you're dealing with revival and a great move of God. And you do remember, if you're going to look at nations, you may say, and this is something I believe in Northern Ireland, I'm going to get in trouble, but people in Northern Ireland, I've had preachers say they need to remember this just as much as Israel did, that there's nothing different about them as a people. Whether you're dealing with race or whatever, it is not. There is no difference. We're all created in the image of God. It's just that God was pleased to move in a mighty way in history. And if you remember, Israel got to think that there was something unique about them as a nation or race. And the Lord said God is able to raise stones, of these stones to raise up children unto Abraham. The Lord did not choose you because you were more in number than any people, for you were fewest of all people, but because the Lord loved you. And that is the gospel, the love of God set upon a people. And when you then look at countries, particularly in Western civilization, you do see a stability because of what the gospel did. If you want to address the commandments, then righteousness. And when I address the commandments, I'm conscious of the fact that the founding fathers, particularly in my country that came to America, they were very concerned about governments addressing the commandments, the Ten Commandments. You'll remember that, maybe you won't remember, but America was pretty much founded by those separatists that left the Church of England because they didn't like a state church. They then came to Holland, and Holland accepted the Belgic Confession and the Heidelberg Catechism, and they're very solid statements. They accepted them as official statements of religion for the state. And the Puritan dissenters, the Pilgrims, as we would call them in America, they said, we don't want the state addressing the first four commandments that deal with loving God. That's the business of the church. And so they left, and they came to America. But they did say that we want the government addressing the last six commandments. You know, that is the issue that deals with the separation of church and state. I believe in a separation of church and state if you're talking about the first four commandments, because I don't want the government addressing religious issues. Now, that's why we really have a problem with Islam. Not because we don't believe in religious freedom. Islam believes that the church and the state is one, right? Romanism, Roman Catholicism, it's the same thing. They believe the church and the state is one, therefore you will lose your religious freedom. But when it comes to the last six commandments, loving your neighbor, That is what we want the state to deal with. They have to deal with that. And that is the laws of Christ. Now, I should just clarify this. This is another subject, so let me not. But the first four commandments, you recognize the fact that if a religion comes in that violates the last six commandments in their religion of the first four commandments, as Islam does by murdering people, and has always been a bloody religion, then you have to address it. But not on the grounds of the first four commandments. You are addressing that on the grounds of the last six commandments, that they are violating the law of God, the last six commandments, which stabilize a nation. But why am I making this point? Because you will find that wherever the gospel has come, righteousness has exalted a nation. When the gospel comes, the first four commandments, that's a stabilizing force. But you can't mandate that in your society. You can allow religion to exist freely, and that includes us. We should be allowed to exist freely and preach against false religion, right? Preach against sin. Preach against homosexual marriage, whatever. We should not be violated in that regard. That's part of the freedoms. But really, at the end of the day as well, we must recognize that the last six commandments, that is what establishes a nation. Because when a man gets saved and justified, he doesn't make void the law through faith. He establishes the law. And that is why you see, historically, in Western civilization, a great amount of stability. Whether you deal with the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill, that addresses the medical field. That is why, even when they're dealing with Ebola right now, they're saying, well, the problem in Liberia, you hear it's coming to North America and everybody's panicking. And they're saying, it is unlikely that it's going to spread in the same way. Why? Because you have had the history of people that were Christians that recognized the sixth commandment, and it has affected, there is a desire to help, to preserve life. I mean, was it not the Puritan John Cotton that addressed the issue of germs and how they spread? I mean, he was a mighty Puritan preacher. Why did he address the issue of germs and washing your hands and all of that? Because the gospel, the sixth commandment, there ought to be a preserving of life. And I recognize that in our, we are drifting, obviously, abortion, euthanasia. We are really floating in many ways on the fumes of common or saving grace. We call it common grace. Our nations are departing from the Bible. If I want to talk about the seventh commandment, when I go to Liberia or many sub-Saharan African countries, you tend to find that the family unit, not everywhere, but it's broken down a lot. I can speak for Liberia. That is completely obliterated because there is a mindset in many of the men that, adultery. Is acceptable, that one man can impregnate many women, have all these children. That is the way society is. Now, again, our society today is becoming like that. But if you would have gone 100 years ago, it was said that divorce was unheard of. You would have heard things like abortion. They did not exist. I say, when I'm speaking of the West, I'm looking at it broadly because today we are drifting away from, we still have common grace that's stabilizing us. At the end of the day, the reason the West is often so different is because the gospel has come. And the gospel has a stabilizing effect. The point I'm going to make tonight, I'm just going to jump ahead because I'm not going to get through all this. Missionaries must still preach the gospel. They have to preach, because that is the answer. The social gospel, well, the gospel affects society. You've heard of the cultural mandate. There's a lot of reformed people that believe in the cultural mandate. I'm going to change the culture. I do not believe in a cultural mandate. It's not even scriptural. Now, you might believe in that. You can if you want. But my point is just to say, I believe in a gospel mandate, but if the gospel is truly the gospel, it will shake and shape the culture. If I want to address the ninth commandment, well, I'm dealing with the ninth commandment, you're not to bear false witness. That is going to affect your courts. One of the challenges we had when someone stole from our bookstore is trying to go into the court. And I wasn't the one that went into the court. It was the Liberian fellow from our store that had to go and deal with the thief. And the judge, everybody wanted money. Well, he said, we don't give money. I said, well, it's against our policy. We do not give any money to a man who is in a position of judgment, whether a judge, a police officer, a customs agent, or whomever. We do not do it. And that made it very difficult. And even that's why you see in many sub-Saharan African countries mob justice. Many ways, no one can get justice in the court. I used to think that was amazing that they would murder someone right on the street. It's not right. It's a violation of the sixth commandment. But it's because they can't get justice in the courts. And you got thieves coming in every day and stealing from you. You know, really, my thoughts in the last 7 years have revolved around the Eighth Commandment and addressing the Eighth Commandment. Because whenever you come, the Eighth Commandment is thou shalt not steal. Whenever you come into a developing country, you immediately, your heart goes out to people and you say, well, now let's talk now about the Eighth Commandment and the issue of work and the issue of poverty that seems to surround people. And the very first day I was in Kenya, someone came to my gate and asked for money for food. The very first day in Liberia, someone came and they asked money for food. And I had heard the saying, don't give a man a fish, but teach him to fish. And I started to discover that you can't even sometimes teach people to fish because they don't want to fish. And I started to see that that seems to be the deeper issue here. And that really was the theme that I've been speaking about in our churches. In other words, when you think about helping the poor and the Eighth Commandment, and we have a responsibility to do that as God's people, and you think about the wealth of the West, and again, we're addressing the issue of righteousness raises up a nation, sin is a reproach to any people, and the Eighth Commandment is the one that really I was puzzled about, because we are commanded to help the poor. But how do we help them as preachers of the gospel and as missionaries? You do have an obligation to help the poor. The Bible doesn't forbid that. It commands it. It is not not the social gospel if it's done properly with the gospel. But one of the things that struck me in the scripture was how careful they were in the early church when they helped the poor. And one verse that I had never really seen in this way before was the verse in 1 Timothy 5 where Paul talks about helping widows in the church. And he said very clearly, do not, or let not a widow be taken into the number. This is 1 Timothy 5:9. Into the number of those that receive aid under 80 years old, having been the wife of one man. In other words, there was an age issue. If a woman who was a widow, she had to be a widow indeed, or truly a widow. In other words, she had to be a certain age, even though she lost her husband, because if she was younger, he said, she might find another husband who will care for her. So she does not qualify for the help and the funds. Not only that, he says she has to have a good testimony to receive money as well. She has to be well reported of for good works, have brought up children, lodged strangers. There was a long list. And I think, he doesn't say why that is, but I think it's because if someone's short of money, is it because of their sin that has brought them into that situation? You know, we live in a day today where we overtax the rich. First of all, we overtax the rich as if someone is always rich through greed. Sometimes people get rich because they work very hard and they work under the glory of God. And if you look at businesses in Western civilization, I can speak for America, many of the businesses were run by godly Christians, and many of them supported missionaries and mission works to spread the gospel. But somehow, today it seems that the poor are poor because the rich are rich. Now, sometimes that's true when there is true exploitation, but not all wealth is at the expense of the poor. And so, at the end of the day, there had to be this testimony, because if the poor are poor because of the sin they are involved in, Paul really says there needs to be a testimony here. I speak about the founders of America. They are the Scots-Irish. If you go back in history, and I should tell you about this book. I've been thinking a lot about this. I say I come to this from the scriptures, but a few years back, I asked the Lord, has no one written on this particular subject of helping the poor and how you deal with the poor? I found a book called The Tragedy of American Compassion. It's a fascinating title, The Tragedy of American Compassion, because America gives all, and your country too, gives all this money to countries that are developing countries. And they just sort of like throw money at things. And I am for charity. I believe that's, again, part of the Sixth Commandment, to help and to preserve life with people that are in need. So don't misunderstand me. But this book actually fell into the hands of President George W. Bush when he was in office, President Clinton, one of our politicians called Newt Gingrich. And they read the book. It was actually written by a Christian. The first chapter was talking about the godly preacher Thomas Chalmers from the Church of Scotland back 100 years ago or so, who was helping the poor in the city of Glasgow. And he divided up the city among his deacons. And he went out and he gave them the gospel. The deacons addressed why they were poor. and tried to help them, but they did it with the gospel. And if a person rejected them and they were in their condition of poverty because of their sin, they would not help them. There was great care, unlike today where someone, a girl can have she has a baby and then she gets more money from the government. It's almost like you are not, it's hard for them to go get a job because they can make more just collecting money. That's an absolute disaster. And at the end of the day, this group in Scotland was called the Scots Society. And it says in this book that the open hand was not extended to all. The society ruled that no profane or dissolute person or openly scandalous shall have any part or portion herein. The able body could readily find jobs in a growing agricultural economy. When they chose not to, it was considered perfectly appropriate to pressure them to change their minds. And that's how they dealt with the poor. And I said to you a minute ago, when I said many in Liberia will say to us, well, you're very wealthy in your country. Well, I said to them, you look at your ground, you have a growing season. That is far more than ours. You can maybe get even three crops. Some of them have told me, I'm not a farmer, but you can get three crops in 1 year. Or you think of the gold rush days in America. We don't have really gold anymore. They have a tremendous amount of gold. They have a tremendous amount of diamonds. They have silver. They actually, a man came out from Northern Ireland from one of our churches that worked with a company called ArcelorMittal where they were getting iron ore. And the ground in Liberia has a tremendous amount of iron ore. Now, you might say, well, it's government corruption. But at the end of the day, righteousness exalts a nation. In a growing democracy, if we can put it that way, governments are often a reflection of the mindset of the people, unless you're dealing with a complete dictatorship. But at the end of the day, even when you overthrow your government, and you see today, like the Arab Spring, you know, America's got this foreign policy where they're going to export democracy and they think that that's the answer. Well, that didn't work in Iraq. It didn't work in Afghanistan. Why? Because democracy only worked with the gospel. If you don't have the gospel and then you export democracy where everybody gets a vote, well, if there's no fear of God, you're just going to create the same thing you tore down. And that has happened in country after country, in Libya, in Tunisia, in Egypt. They got the Muslim Brotherhood, or Lebanon, where they got Hezbollah, what you see happening in Syria today. And I'm not for dictatorships, but when we have these political things like democracy, they flow from the gospel. Who was it, the founding father of America, that says democracy is nothing more than two foxes and one rabbit voting on what they're going to have for dinner? Just because the majority says something doesn't make it right. So you have that where today they're redefining marriage and all of that. Just because the majority, see, that is the challenge today. In America, in my country, we're divided in our nation. So we have a group of people that have turned from the Bible. And so they start to yell at us to say, you're violating my freedoms. I am free. And I say to them, freedom and rights, they were never unrestrained. They always were tempered by God's law in a gospel society. So they've completely redefined freedom. Freedom, the land of the free and the home of the brave, was never a license to do whatever you wanted to do. And by the way, it was never a license to do, you know, you can do whatever you want as long as it doesn't hurt anybody else. Well, that addresses the issue of homosexuality or the things that are done privately in someone's bedroom. At the end of the day, what's done there in private, it will affect your society because morality, the law, it's a spiritual thing. And so the nation will decline. The Roman Empire has proved and shown us that. Okay, that's another subject. But the point, let me get back to what I'm saying. When you address the issue of the Eighth Commandment and money, you have to recognize that it is the gospel that will change the society. That's what Chalmers did. So in America, when this book, The Tragedy of American Compassion, was actually read by President Bush, they actually changed the welfare system in America to workfare. The people actually had to do a little work. And they started to wise up because they saw that the early Christians recognized that work was the issue. You see, what he was really addressing in this book, and all books that deal with this from a Christian perspective, understand that work was instituted by God before the fall. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 15, when God took man and put him in the garden, he put him there to dress it and to keep it. And of course, the dressing is the word to labor, to work, to till. To keep is the word to observe, to guard, to keep watch over. And so the challenge comes in when the fall comes, the Lord makes it clear, cursed is the ground for your sake. It's going to grow thorns and thistles. In sorrow, you're going to eat of your bread. And that is where the challenge comes in. That's why the gospel has shaped the West in regard to its wealth, because men worked. And of course, they worked to the glory of God. One of the things that John Calvin and Luther as well, Martin Luther, preached, first it was justification, as I said a minute ago. And when men saw that they were justified, they were now liberated in their work. Prior to the Reformation in the Middle Ages, men worked, they were in bondage. Even their daily labors that they did, they knew they were measured by God's law, and they had no hope of salvation because they knew they were sinful. When justification, that truth, was preached, men were so freely liberated, and it affected then how they lived in their life. And so whether they ate or drank, they did it all to the glory of God with great joy. And that's what shaped the West. It was that work ethic. You know what else you notice? That Calvin actually preached as well something else. He said every man, every believer, has a call and a vocation from God. In that day, prior to the Reformation, people thought only the preacher had the vocation and call of God. He says, no, the farmer also has a call of God. It's true that the preacher has a high call, but it's not in the sense that this man has no call over here. He has a calling of God too. So when men saw, as farmers, I'm doing the work of God, now they would witness in their daily life, don't misunderstand me, but they understood that they were tilling the ground to the glory of God because that is what God called them to. That's what affected, that's what the Scots-Irish, and you can see even in Northern Ireland, the farming, that's why you see gospel nations. You have a tremendous difference. If I want to look at North America, which was the gospel, and I go to South America, which was not the gospel, Romanism, you see a difference in the wealth of the nations. Of course, that affects all of the last six commandments, but particularly the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal. Because remember, Paul did say, Ephesians 4, let him that stole steal no more, but let him labor. I mean, even when you read the larger catechism, question 141, on the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal, it actually addresses work. The duties required in the eighth commandment are provident care and study to get, keep, use, dispose of those things which are necessary and convenient to sustain you, to sustain your nature, that are suitable to your condition, a lawful calling, diligence in it, frugality, thriftiness. That's what the larger catechism, the Westminster Divines in England, actually said. So stealing, the contrast to that is work. And so you see that throughout the world. You see that in Northern Ireland. Some of you know the history of Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. You have two separate countries. And you have tension there. And anybody will tell you 30 years ago that generally the same farming was not there as it was in the north of the Scots-Irish. That was a reality. Why was it? Because, oh, they're a different race. No. It's because it was the religious background, the roots of that background. And you see then, that's what I believe. I'm not an Ulster person, but I believe that's what the IRA, the whole thing was about. Because you have the north, and they say, well, they have the best lands. That is the same thing, can I say, in South Africa. I am not for apartheid. Apartheid is the dividing the societies by race. I'm not for apartheid. But at the end of the day, I recognize that 300 years ago, the Dutch Protestants who were fleeing persecution left Europe and went to South Africa. And they took large tracts of land that were untouched. And you see the wealth that is there in regard to diamonds and all that, but the farming. They became a breadbasket, as well as Zimbabwe, for sub-Saharan Africa. A tremendous wealth there. And at the end of the day, many of the Bantu then came down to that area because they wanted to rightly share in that wealth, and some of them did. But again, like America, like Canada, you have a generation now. We're going to jump 300 years later, and what do you have? You have a racist issue that addresses that you get apartheid. That's why I say when you look at the roots, it is not in the roots often race. It is culture, a cultural issue. And so when you look at different cultures, you have to recognize that. I think Paul was recognizing this very thing when he said to Titus, when Titus was going to go back to Crete. And Paul said, there's something about the Cretans you should know about. He says, now, they will say this. This is their culture. They will say this. So their own poets say that the Cretans, well, they're always liars. They're evil beasts. They are slow bellies. The word slow belly is actually the word slow. It references work. And belly is the word for food. It was a slowness to work to get food. Because that is why we work at the end of the day. And Paul had addressed it with Thessalonica as well. That is, those cultures that have come from a background where the gospel was not there in the same way. And so in Thessalonica, Paul had to address this. He said it's a gospel issue. But by the way, before I leave Titus, when Titus said that about the Cretans, one of their own prophets, Paul said this witness is true. But then he said to Titus, rebuke them sharply that they might be sound in the faith. It was a gospel issue. As a missionary, I have to come in and I have to help people and teach them even about work. One of the challenges we had in Liberia was that the pastors maybe understood that they were going to get their salaries from us. And I said, well, if we did this for the bookstore, why not tithe? Why not the people tithe? Then you think about tithing. Let's talk about the cost of living. As I said a minute ago, sometimes they say $2 a day, and that's not the same as it. But by the way, before I talk about that, a lot of people, I believe, in third developing world countries, they define poverty by comparing themselves with maybe America or the West. And they say, until I reach that level of wealth, I'm poor. And the scripture actually doesn't define poverty that way. It says in 1 Timothy 6, godliness with contentment is great gain. We brought nothing into this world. It certainly will carry nothing out. And having food and raiment, we are therewith to be content. And then it goes on to say, for the love of money is the root of all evil. Food is your food and water. Raiment is your clothing and your basic shelter, enough to keep you from the elements, the rain and the sun by day and all of that. And, you know, we need to remember that here too, because we go to the other extreme, workaholics, but others have to remember that from the other side as well and say, well, oh, no, I'm thinking I got to reach that level before. God doesn't say that. He says God has called you to meet your needs, and we have to preach that to them. So if I say to the people there, you know, you should be tithing to pay your own, we can't, we're poor. No, wait a minute. If you got 10 heads of household in your congregation that are breathing, that means you are getting your food and your raiment, your basic needs met. If 10 of you will tithe, that's 10 times 10. That's 100%. That's enough to help your pastor as well. And it is. And it can be done. And our people are doing it. They're actually, and then they decided that we got the split air conditioners just like you have on your wall. We put two of them in. And they're actually now paying the electricity for that. So part of it is that, and I think we have the tragedy of American compassion, we have destroyed them because we're, and again, we help the poor, the issue of Ebola right now, because of the, we're helping them with some staple foods because the economy is struggling, right? Or medical, we have a medical fund for emergency cases. Why? Because that meets the definition of poverty. They cannot afford some of the medical care and they will die. So that's the sixth commandment. We have a responsibility to help them. But if we're dealing with the average person, we have to remember what Paul said to the church at Thessalonica. We hear that there are some walking among you disorderly, working not at all. Them that are such, we command and exhort by our Lord Jesus Christ. This is a gospel issue. That with quietness they work and they eat their own bread. And that's what we have to remember, eating of the own bread. And so I say these things in the context of that truth, righteousness exalteth the nation. And I think this is important because what can happen is that people will appeal to overseas in this internet age and say, we need help. And people do that all the time from our mission works. And we say, wait. We have this person under discipline, maybe in our little committee where we have admonished them to work. And they're refusing. Of course, then at the end of the day, we have that responsibility to teach that. And that's been a burden to me ever since going to Liberia. Because when you really think about it, when you look at the history of Liberia, and I'll end with this, the history of Liberia is a very, very interesting history. I said a minute ago, and maybe you've never heard this, that Liberia today, the structure of its government was founded by freed American slaves. After America got independence from England, they started to address the issues of inalienable rights and freedom. And a number of Christians started to recognize that what they were doing by enslaving a whole race was a violation of the Eighth Commandment. I know to us today, it is amazing that they did not see that. But at the end of the day, they recognized that it was a violation of the Eighth Commandment, and many Americans began to release their slaves. And what happened was then there were many free. Now, some, it was not such a righteous cause. Some were afraid. because of the slaves killing their slave masters out of frustration. And therefore, they also released their slaves. But in America, you had a large number of slaves that then were released. And there were Christians, many of them, that came together to form what was known as the American Colonization Society. And they wanted to help these freed slaves who would not get a chance to go, to have anything in America to go back to Africa. And so they did. In 1822, the first ship, it was voluntary. They asked who wanted to go. They felt they'd have 200. They had 1,000 show up, and they began to help them to go back. Now, where do I get my information? This is very interesting because I've read a lot of things in Liberia. Very hard to know the details. I've spoken to the Minister of Information who was under one of the administrations during the war. He comes into our bookstore all the time. He's a Christian. I've spoken to a lot of people, and I've read some of the books that are there. And there is a debate in the history, but I read from a book from actually 1847. I was amazed to find it in the archives of Princeton University. And it was a book written by a godly Presbyterian minister named Archibald Alexander. It's called The History of Colonization in West Africa. Now, he's 1847, so he doesn't know today what the things are, but he looks back at his time from the perspective of the American Colonization Society, and they brought people over. And the first ship that came over in 1822 of these freed slaves, there were a number of them that were believers, many that wanted to, were seeing themselves as missionaries to spread the gospel. Because you remember, if you know the history of the slave plantations, George Whitefield, the preacher, when many were prejudiced against the slaves and the black man, that he went into the plantations and he actually preached the gospel. He actually had an orphanage for children. And many, many of the slaves were saved and came to know the Lord. And you can see that even in the culture. There is that history that is there and the mind of spiritual things. And at the end of the day, then they went back to West Africa. Well, what they found when they got there was that the West African indigenous people would not let them on the land. And in Liberia today, there's an island called Providence Island. And the freed slaves named it that because that's where they lived, just off the coast of Liberia. And the indigenous people would not let them, the freed slaves, on the land because they knew that they were freed slaves. And the indigenous people in West Africa did not want slavery to end. They knew that America was addressing this issue. They knew about England addressing the issue. And there was then the American Navy and the British Navy seeking to stop the French and those that were the village chiefs that were actually going into places like the St. Paul River where we live, where they murdered all the adults and took all the children and sold them into slavery. And so at the end of the day, slavery was coming to an end. Of course, in America, it didn't die for 30 years later, really. And then civil rights took another 100 years before there was a recognition in the hearts and minds of people that had for years had prejudice that God created all men. Slavery, of course, in America was a great scourge. But when you come to Liberia, you do have among the freed slaves, in the very beginnings of the time in Liberia, there was a sense of a rule of law, and there was a work ethic. Later, things began to change, but in the beginnings, you had a different culture coming because the gospel came with the freed slaves, and you can see the fruits of that in Liberia because you have the Baptists, the Methodists, the Presbyterian churches, and you see that influence that's there. But what you had then because of that was two cultures. One culture that really had African traditional religion and superstition, and another that had the gospel. And that created a tension between those two cultures. It's not to say that all that came over from America did all right, but there was that difference. And so at the end of the day, when you come up to the 1980s, in some sense, that is what the Civil War was about. It was an indigenous master sergeant in the Liberian Armed Forces that went into the executive mansion, President Tolbert, and murdered him. President Tolbert was trying to get the people in Liberia to grow their own crops, rice especially. And the government was subsidizing the price of rice to keep it down where the people can afford it. And Tolbert said, I'm going to take the subsidy off and let them see the price as it really is that they might grow rice. Of course, he was growing rice himself as an example. And when he took the rice price, the subsidy off, the price went up. Everybody thought, well, he's obviously making money on this. And at the end of the day, what happened was, instead of growing rice, it caused what was known as the rice riots. And they rioted in the city, and then 1 year later, his life, well, life was taken. And that was the beginning of the 14-year Civil War. And I say all that because I believe the roots of much of this, not all of it, much of it is this idea of the work ethic that the people have, and that they, even today, after 10 years after the war, the country maybe outwardly looks good, but they're missing the idea because they're looking to their government to do that which they should be doing for themselves. And we as Christians, we have to preach to the people that you have a responsibility to work. And if a man doesn't work, he shouldn't eat. The bottom line is that righteousness does exalt a nation, and it's sin that is a reproach to any people. And as preachers of the gospel, as we go and preach salvation, we have to apply it to people in their lives, and we have to address the commandments in their life. We deal with the first four as preachers, but we also in society, we deal with the last six. If I'm preaching to sinners on the street, they are always looking to me for money. So I use this method, the law of God, as a schoolmaster to drive men to Christ. And we point them to Christ through this means, often through the eighth commandment. But if it's a Christian, I also have to use the law and the gospel to show them what God requires of us as believers. And we have helped people start businesses. I did that in Kenya. I helped a guy. I said, look, you want to start a chicken business. He wanted to do it. I said, great, let's do it like a Christian. Buy the best food, the most expensive chicken food, and your chickens will be really good. And maybe you'll wipe all the other businesses out because everybody wants your chickens. And that's what we did. And all the restaurants wanted his chickens. And he was frugal with his money, and he was careful. And now he has a business. And that's what Ian Harris did that as well, our missionary from Northern Ireland, the president of our mission board, to help believers to start businesses. That's the call also in countries like this that God has called us to work and labor. So I wanted to share this because it has been a burden on my heart. I would ask you to pray that you would help us. Some of the same challenges are faced in Jamaica. I'm going to go there for 2 months, and it is not easy, even for Christians there. And we need to pray that the Lord will help us as we remind them, even from the Scriptures. And, of course, remind ourselves, because I think we forget it. We're trying to export the benefits of the Gospels and the blessings of the Gospel apart from the Gospel. That's a disaster. You don't want to do that. But the Gospel, rightly preached in all of its application, will shape a people. If it's not a revival, it's not going to change the whole nation. But you can change a community for Christ. And I pray that as we establish in the will of the Lord in the next 5 years, maybe, a Christian school and other things, that we teach people the gospel and the application of the gospel. Let's close in a word of prayer. Our Father in heaven, we pray that as thy people, you would give us great wisdom as we labor in foreign countries, as we come to cultures that are not the same as ours, that we would remember even why we have seen the blessings in the past, and that we would be shaken to not forget what God did through the gospel as we see our nation declining and departing and redefining marriage and justifying all these sins. But Lord, give us help as we go into other countries, that we would not seek to moralize people, but we would preach to them the gospel and show them what flows from it in their lives. Lord, give us wisdom. Give us great guidance as we serve and labor, particularly in Liberia. And we ask, Lord, that thy people tonight, even from what they heard, would get a greater understanding and appreciation for the work of God overseas. We ask this in Christ's name and for his glory. Amen.